The title of this lecture is What is Marriage? There's hardly a subject more important to understand than that concerning marriage. It seems to be one of the basic building blocks to developing and maintaining a proper society and civilization. And people of all political or religious persuasions are interested in marriage in one way or another. And I would dare say that most of you listening to this lecture are vitally concerned about the matter. After all, not only is it mentioned in the Bible as an important social and legal institution, but even in situations dealing with our secular states today, the subject of marriage is of fundamental concern. In this lecture, I wish to discuss the basic factors which make up this concept called marriage. We will use the Bible and its illustrations, as well as examples and principles from our modern world. There will probably be some real surprises in this lecture, things you may not have thought of before. What I wish to do is to present them to you in an academic fashion for your personal evaluation. I intend them as suggestions, not dogmatic pronouncements. Everyone must make up his or her own mind on the interpretation of subjects such as these. Indeed, hardly two people will precisely agree on all points concerning marriage. All I want to do is to present an honest and concise appraisal of the subject and let you draw your own conclusions. Let me say at the outset that I am not in any way trying to establish new and independent concepts about the institution of marriage. What I want to do is to evaluate, as best as I know how, and in an honest and fair way, what marriage has always been, how God has looked upon marriage, how societies of the past have looked upon marriage. In other words, just where did we get these principles of marriage that we have adopted today? That is really what the whole problem is when we really come to understand this subject. So I'm not trying to establish something new. What I want to do, if I possibly can, is to show what it always has been like and to give the principles from the very beginning of the Bible so that we might be able to comprehend this subject far better. In no way am I trying to influence you or society into believing some newfangled ideas of my own about the matter. Now, that is certain. Still, I wish to present the facts as I see them, and I'm thankful to God for the privilege of doing that. And I'm also thankful that you could listen to this lecture on this subject. However, I do believe that we all need, and that includes me, we need to brush aside the cobwebs about this subject which have developed in our modern minds. We need to look back and to see just what the Bible reveals on the matter of marriage. So I'm going to give you some suggestions for evaluation, not dictates as the leader of a church on earth who's supposed to be God's representative to tell you or the world what to do on these matters. Now, we have too much of that already, and we don't need any more of it. Within this framework of what I've been talking about here in this introduction, this framework of research, let us now look at the subject of marriage. And I hope we can do it in an unemotional way, in an academic way, and in a historical one, but one in which we could understand or can understand these concepts a little better. All right, first of all, what is marriage itself? Marriage really needs to be defined. And let me tell you right at the outset, marriage, the word marriage, is a legal term. Absolutely, it is legal. It has nothing to do of itself with sex, with having children, with sharing any intimacy of life, or even with loving a person of the opposite sex. Marriage of itself has nothing to do with those things. Now, it's quite true that those things do involve things of marriage, and many societies, and even in the Bible, things relating to sex or having children and sharing the intimacies of life, and you would hope within an environment of love, are factors that are associated with marriage. But if we say that those things in themselves are a part of marriage, we're making a big mistake. Marriage is a legal thing. And I'll tell you what it is. In the Bible, it is defined as a covenant. Now, that's in Malachi chapter 2 and verse 14 is one verse. It is a covenant. And we have an illustration of this in the very beginning of the Bible. That is, at the beginning of Israel as a nation. When God brought Israel out of Egypt at the Exodus under Moses, he took them to Mount Sinai, and there it says he made a covenant with them. Now, we call that the Old Covenant today, since we have in the New Testament information about the New Covenant. Okay, the Old Covenant, then, was made between God and Israel back there at Mount Sinai. God was looked upon at that time as a male, which he is in all sections of the Scripture, when he is defined, that is, and Israel is called a she. Now, though they're both men and women in Israel, the nation of Israel, the whole nation is almost always put in the feminine gender, as though Israel is a she. And a marriage really took place back there at Mount Sinai, and the Old Covenant is nothing more than a marriage covenant between God and Israel. And in Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 14, God even said through Jeremiah, I am married unto you. Talking to Israel. There was a marriage relationship. I might also say that God divorced Israel a little bit later on, and Jeremiah was talking about that. That also is a legal term, which we will talk about a little bit later on. But the covenant that was made back there at Mount Sinai is, or was appraised and understood by the ancient people, Moses particularly, and finally the prophets, as being a marriage contract between God on the one hand and Israel on the other. Now, a covenant is a contract, and it's a legal matter. It's like a legal document. You know, you set down the terms of the covenant, or let's call it a contract. It's more clear to us in modern terms to realize that, or to use that term. It's a covenant. It's a legal matter, and you put down the terms of the covenant that the party of the first part will do all of this, and the party of the second part will do all of this. And then you put it down in writing, and at the end of it, you sign your names to it. Back in the Old Testament period at Mount Sinai, they killed the lamb, split it in two, let the blood come through, out of the lamb, and then took this written document called the Old Covenant through that blood, you see, and sprinkled it with the blood of the animal, and thereby it became a legal document. A legal document. And I want you to notice, really, there was nothing in this marriage document about God having sex with Israel. You see, now this is silly, I know, but it's important to understand this point. There were certain do's and don'ts. That's quite true. And Israel agreed with God, who was their husband, you know, to do these things, and they agreed to it. And God said, in return, I agree to do this. And if you abide by the covenant, well, everything will be fine, and I know I'll abide by the covenant, he says, and everything will be fine on my part. And you know how long the Old Covenant was to last? It was to last for the lifetime of every single individual who was living there around Mount Sinai. You see, it was a lifetime covenant. Now, what if Israel would break that covenant? Well, then God had a right to, if he wanted to disallow it, because in the contract, you either do this or else. You see the point? All right. Now, the thing is, a marriage covenant, then, in the Old Testament way, and this is reflected in the New Testament, too, is nothing more than a contract. It's a legal matter. It's a legal matter that people agree to do things together, and then to fulfill the obligations of it. And if a person wouldn't fulfill the obligations, well, then they would be said to be desecrating the covenant, or not keeping the covenant, and then penalties would come in as a result of that. Now, the thing is, on a marriage, since we're talking about marriage here, we've got to realize one thing. Since marriage is a covenant in the Bible, and a contract between two people, or between God and the whole nation of Israel in that particular case there, but let's now bring it down to the two people illustration, because that's what we're more interested in today. Since it's a contract and a covenant between two people, then there must be some kind of agreement that is made between those two people, you see. Now, in the case of a religious marriage or covenant or contract, God comes into it. But I'll tell you how God comes into it. He comes into it as one who binds it. As one, that's what it says in the Bible. What God has bound in heaven, let no man put asunder here on this earth. It involves the marriage contract. It certainly does back in the Old and the New Testament times. But it didn't mean that God was married to the couple. He's married to Israel generally, you know, in symbol. But God would oversee and ratify and be witness to, you see, the covenant made between a man and a woman. And then whatever was agreed to by that man and woman, God would expect that the two people would abide by it. Now, that's where God comes into it. And an appeal was often made to God by a wife or by a husband if someone was doing something wrong. Oh, God, you were the one who was witness, you know, to this. Notice how he is doing wrong, or maybe how she is doing wrong, or something like that. God comes into it in the sense of overseeing and ratifying the covenant made between the two people. But the two people are the ones that enter into the covenant, you see. This is the way that it was. Now, what is most important is this. What goes into that covenant, that is, what is in that contract, is most important. What is it that the people who make the contract agree to? If they agree to it, and it's within the framework, let's say, of the Old Testament, well, certain things would be expected for these two people to do, you see. Society would have demanded that certain things be done for themselves and for the children that would come along and things like that. It's most important what goes into the contract. Now, in the Old Testament period, let me tell you that some things that were allowed in a contract that may be surprising to some of us today. Now, I am not a supporter of polygamy for any reason whatsoever. I have seen it work down there in Palestine amongst people who believe in it. Or I should say, I've seen it not work. That's the point I really should say. I have seen it in action. I have never seen, in my judgment, polygamy having any good, efficacious effects whatsoever on society or on the people who are involved in it. Now, I am not going to judge on the matter because God allowed it in the Old Testament, and there are actually laws governing plurality of marriages. One man can having more than one wife in the Old Testament. And now Moses had more than one wife, and others of the later period had more than one wife. And indeed, even in the book of Kings, it says that the righteous priest Jehoiada actually took two wives, two women, and by the Spirit of God, it says, and gave them to the king of Israel to marry. So now that's by the Spirit of God. Now, this is most interesting because, you see, that was allowed back there. I don't think it's the best, but that's Ernest Martin speaking. But I can't argue with God on this matter. And let me tell you, I'm in no way am I going to enter into a polygamous relationship with anyone. I mean, two women being married to me, or three or four, it would be hopeless. And I'll tell you, gentlemen, the rest of you would be the same way, too. Let me tell you, that is a fact. But in the Old Testament times, it was perfectly proper for a polygamous relationship to take place, plus many other things. Now, a contract, you see, that was made back there in the time of, let's say, earlier Abraham. He was married to two women and had had one concubine. Jacob had two wives and he had two concubines. And then Moses had two wives, and don't let anybody tell you he didn't. He did. He had two wives at the same time. And there's legislation in the Mosaic law which allows for it, and God put it in there by the inspiration of God's Holy Spirit. And in the Old Testament period, this was allowed. Now, a contract for a marriage between a young man and a young girl would have been allowed at that time to include polygamy, you see, if they would have wanted it. Now, that would not be just between the man and the woman. Well, I beg your pardon, it would, in the sense that the woman would have said, I will allow you to have another wife. See the point? If you want one. Or I will allow you to have two wives, if you want one. Now, that would have to be in the contract. Now, it might not be written in there, but the whole society would know that that's it. And when two people got married with one with another, it would be understood that that's in the contract. You know, that's in the contract. Now, there are many, many other things that you could think about in Old Testament times that really, to us today, would be rather shocking that were allowed back at that time. And I will say this about a wife. When a woman married a man back in the Old Testament time, she literally became the slave of the man. The man became owner of the person, of the woman. In fact, the word husband in the Old Testament means owner, the one who owns the wife, and she becomes his property. And I'll tell you, all types of things could be done by that man and the rest of to that woman. And the rest of society, unless it specifically disagreed with the law of Moses, you see, which the society generally accepted in ancient Israel, that man could do anything he wanted because that woman was his slave. He owned her just like a herd of goats. And that is a fact. That is a fact. In the Ten Commandments, for example, on the Sabbath day, when it mentions that, The man is commanded to keep the Sabbath himself, the maidservant, the manservant, the daughter, and the son, and even the cattle. But you know who's not mentioned? The wife. The wife is not mentioned because when it said the man owns the wife, and the wife is a part of the man, you know, being one flesh, the way that society back there looked at it, and even God. And it actually meant that she doesn't even figure into it because she's a part of that husband. The husband owns her, and never will he get rid of her except through divorce or something like that, which was allowed back there. Also, let me just speak about divorce a moment. It was allowed in the Old Testament. Jesus said it wasn't the best. It said for the hardness of people's hearts. All right, that's true. Hardness of people's hearts. Today we don't have any hardness of hearts, do we, in this modern world? Well, we do have, but back there they had it. And Jesus said that Moses allowed divorce, and if Moses allowed it, then God sanctioned it. A divorce, then, is something bad and terrible. No one likes divorces. We all know that. But let me say this. When two people got married back there, under the auspices of the old covenant relationship given by Moses from God, there were laws in there governing divorce, and so both the man and the woman living in that society would have been well aware that divorce was a possibility, even though the marriage should be for life. You see? It should be for life. But it could be cut off, and there's legislation in there where those two could be loosed from one another, but they had to do it by law. You see, divorce, by the way, is also a legal term, completely legal term. It means that a marriage, which is a legal term, a contract, has been dissolved. It's made null and it's been made void through legal proceedings. So that's a legal term as well. So the most important thing is the contract and the society in which you live and exercise or make that contract. Now, in New Testament times, things had moderated tremendously as far as the position of the woman is concerned. But still, even there, polygamy was allowed in the New Testament period. It wasn't practiced all that much. In fact, it was frowned upon for the general people. But King Herod, for example, had several wives, and it was perfectly acceptable from that point of view. And another thing, you know, in Matthew chapter 25, when Christ gives the illustration of the 10 virgins that are waiting for the bridegroom to come back from heaven. And obviously he is the bridegroom, there's no question about that. And remember how 10 of the virgins were wise and 10 of the virgins were unwise? Well, what we find is 5 were wise, I'm sorry, and 5 were unwise. Well, what happened was that 5 of them went into the marriage supper. And you know what those virgins were going to do? They were going to marry the bridegroom. They weren't dancing girls. Some people say they're dancing girls. They'd do anything to get monogamous relationships coming out. And I agree on monogamous relationships. I've already stated that. But you know, let's not use an illustration given by Christ, which speaks about the possibility of 10 virgins marrying one bridegroom and bring monogamous relationships into it when it wasn't even intended, you see. Now, we have literature on this subject of the 10 virgins. And if you have not read this very interesting exposition, send for it. I think you'll find that Christ was talking about all 10 of those virgins, but only 5 of them did this in his illustration, marrying the bridegroom at one time. He's using a polygamous relationship to explain a Christian principle about his second coming back to this earth. Nothing wrong with that, because at that time they didn't think that it was bad like you and I do today. So, when a person got married in New Testament times, though it had been moderated tremendously from the earlier times of Abraham and Moses and David, still, when people got married, the contract that was made between the two was within the environment of the laws governing the land at the time, and the two people were expected to abide by it. Now, they never had documents, really, in the Old Testament or New Testament periods proving that someone was married. You know, getting a marriage license is a state kind of a thing, or getting some document of some kind, or certainly taking vows. They never took vows. Vows are a modern institution, going back to the Middle Ages, in actual fact, but I mean modern as far as the Bible is concerned. And we have an exposition on that which you should write for. Are vows a part of marriage? The answer is no. Not at all. A vow, you see, is something you make to God. Or you can make it to some other person, but I mean in a religious sense, you make it to God. But all that a marriage is a contract between two people. And no one knows exactly how that was consummated in Old or New Testament times, but we're almost certain of one thing. It was the marriage feast, the marriage supper, where the two people got together, and the parents, on the one hand, and the parents on the other, brought the couple together. They had a big marriage feast, and at the end of the feast, they did all types of little rituals, whatever, breaking glasses or whatever it might be, and then they would then go to their own home. And that was, in the eyes of the whole community, since they all had plenty to eat and plenty to drink and plenty to dance, you know, and all of that, it was a witness between all these people that these two were married. They didn't have any document of any kind, and no way did they have anything like that. All right, now, it's the environment in which we live that is very important. And today, situation has been much moderated as far as the role of the woman is concerned. And I'm thankful and grateful for that. I think we need a greater equality on all of these matters. But there's a role for a man and a role for a woman. We all know that. But today, it's a different situation. And in almost all areas of the world, that is in the Western world, polygamy is outlawed. And I think it's one of the finest laws that you could possibly imagine. Slavery is also outlawed. And though a woman, if she marries a man that's going to be a tyrant, well, that's up to her, I guess, but she doesn't have to put up with it, does she? Maybe she does, if she feels she must. But you see, we now have a different situation in which we live. And the contracts that are now made between a man and a woman are made within our environment that we find around us, whether it be secular or whether it be religious. And it's the environment around us which is very, very important. Really, what it gets down to is that marriage, a contract between two people to do certain things, is that they must agree one with the other. And by the way, that's perfectly proper. If two people love each other or whatever, and they want to get married, they ought to sit down and agree, either in writing or verbally or whatever, I will do this if you will do this. I will do this if you will do this, etc., etc. And then they sign the document, or in their minds make a covenant, you see, and then have God to oversee it and bring it into effect, ratify it, so to speak, then they ought to abide by the covenant that they have made. Now, if they grow in knowledge or something and find out some of the things that they said before because they were young and didn't understand, if they both agree to modify it, well, any contract can be modified, can't it? Between two people, if the two people are involved? Of course. I mean, no problem whatsoever as time goes on. But if the point is, if one person doesn't want to agree to a contract that is, I mean, if the contract has been made and another person doesn't want to agree, then we might have to get into litigation or some problems over that. That's quite true. But the marriage, you see, is simply a contract that is made between two people, and they ought to abide by it. And the contracts are normally governed by the societies in which we live. Now, that is very definite. Let me give you an example now, going right back to the very beginning of the Bible, to speak about this society business and how it's very important when it comes to marriage and these contracts I'm talking about here. If we go all the way back to the Garden of Eden, here is, after all of the creation is made according to the first chapter of the book of Genesis, then we have Adam made, and finally he is presented with Eve. So here they are in the Garden of Eden, and there are two of them. Now, look at the society as depicted in this example in Genesis. There are only two people involved in the society here on earth, that is, humans. God comes into it, and there was a serpent that could talk as well. But I mean, as far as the two people were concerned, it was Adam and Eve. Do you know, they didn't need a marriage document. Eve didn't need a marriage document to prove that she was married to Adam, because if Adam died, which he didn't, but if Adam died, she'd be left alone, wouldn't she? She'd inherit all his property in the first place. You see the point? Or if Eve would die, it'd be the same thing there. Now, if two people are alone together, you know, you don't even have to have, in a sense, a contract for I'll stay with you and live with you, you know, as man or wife, whatever it is, if you do these things, if only the only two of you are there, you say, only two are there. That is, if you want to live together. And you don't have to have all types of agreements because you're the only one there. I suppose if two people wanted to go down to the South Pacific at the present time, and you're on this desert island down there, but you could live down there, what if you weren't married? And all of a sudden, you wanted to live together, you know, as man and wife. Do you have to, or would you think you'd have to wait for some minister to come on a boat before you have a contract, you know, and signed, sealed, and delivered? Well, you'd be like in the Garden of Eden. Just take it up before God, as far as I'm concerned. I think that's perfectly the way that it should be. If there's no governing society, you see, around you to tell you one way or another what to do, and that you're not offending anybody by what you do. You see the point that I'm getting at? That's the reason I'm giving this illustration of Garden and Eden, or if you're on a desert island, two people together, you're not interfering with society whatsoever. Now, as soon as children would come along, though, if you were in this idyllic situation and you had children, well, what if you had one? That wouldn't pose much of a problem, but it could. Because if you would die, there'd be the firstborn child and the wife left. Who is it that's going to share in the property? You see the point? There's where a marriage covenant, that usually goes in a marriage covenant. It deals with property. It deals with money. It deals with other things that you can think of. This is where the contract is most important. Then if you have two children, then you've got to delineate, you know, in the contract, which is a part of the marriage contract, what they have, and then three and four and five. And the more people you have around, suppose now you have another couple that come on the other side of the island, I'm getting idyllic here, and you come into relationships with one another. All of a sudden, they've got to know that you two are married, that you have a contract between each other and your children, which they should honor, and they want you to honor any contract that they might have, you see, between themselves and their children. And the more you multiply situation like this, the legality comes into the whole thing, and you got a society which has developed, and that is where marriage becomes most important, because it has to do with inheritance, you see? It has to do with the love that you might have for your wife or husband or children, and you want to protect them. You want to give your children a name. You know, we talk about people getting married today to give and to have children because it's legal, it's proper, and it's, of course that is the case, and you have children coming along and everybody accepts it. They take the last name of the father. And that's fine, because you know what that means? That means they are legally, as far as society is concerned, attached to the father, and that way, and to the mother too, and that way there is something legal involved in it, and that's why marriage is so important. Let me tell you, even in secular societies today, in the Soviet Union, where they do not believe in God at all, and they don't even bring God into it, or in China, they still insist on marriage, because you see, a marriage, that is a contract, I mean, and it doesn't involve whether you have sex or not. It doesn't, or intimate, or whether you love one another even. Maybe they should, but you see. But it doesn't involve that. It's a legal matter involving inheritance and responsibility one to another. And especially if you have children coming along. Now, going back to the time of Abraham, remember, in his society, polygamy was allowed. And it was perfectly all right for a man to have more than one wife, and lots of other things were accepted at that time. And when Abraham and Sarah, and then finally Keturah, or he had a concubine called Hagar, when they came together, they all understood what the society accepted, and they went by it. All right, you can come up to the time of Christ. It was the same thing there. Today, we have two types of marriage which are in existence at the present time in our modern society. Two types, and each is governed by the requirements of the society in which we find ourselves. Now, this is most important. First of all, let me talk about the secular marriage, which is the normal one, which could be in the Soviet Union, you know, or China, or here in the United States of America, or here we are in the state of California. California laws vary a little bit from Nevada laws and Arizona laws and New York laws, etc., etc. We all know that. But here, first of all, we have marriage that is being performed by justices of the peace or by others. So that's quite true. But in a secular society, they prefer that people get married. Now, that's the normally it. You don't have to here in the state of California. People can live together if they want to. And there's no crime against the state if everything goes fine. I mean, there's no crime against the state whatsoever. I'm not saying that's right. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying there's no crime against the state. But it's normal that most people get married. And when a young couple or an older couple get married, what they are doing is letting the state, in this case, and if they want to bring God into it, that's up to them. But they're letting the state be the arbiter, or shall we say, the overseer or the ratifier of the covenant that they make between themselves. Now, what they desire to do, that is, what they agree to, the state doesn't enter into that at all, except this. When it comes to inheritance, property, money, whatever, well, the state will then say the wife has her share and the husband has his share. You see, when it comes to children, then the state will intervene there too through the court system, etc., etc. But in a secular type of society that we have here in California at the present time, if you want to be married in it, you are expected to abide by the laws of the land. And when marriage takes place, a covenant takes place, especially, you've got to agree with what the state says, at least that much. It doesn't involve sex, normally, because that's your personal matter. It doesn't involve lots of things, intimate, that you would do while you're married. But it does involve legal matters, and the state would interfere there and intervene at their request or at your request. However, there's a second type of marriage, and this is the one that most of us are interested in, I think, because it deals with the Bible, especially in our United States here, because it's the religious type of marriage, which can supersede or be a part of the secular. Some religious groups, believe it or not, don't even recognize secular marriages performed by a justice of the peace. You've got to be married by, let's say, this preacher or this priest or this rabbi or something of that nature. All right, now, if people are married in a religious society, notice all of a sudden that the society in which they're married, if they are part of that religious society, let's say a particular church denomination, and that church denomination is very strict on moral things as they interpret them, on ethical principles as they interpret them, on all types of legal matters of inheritance as they interpret them. All right, if you are, two people want to get married and have a contract, and you want to be married by this minister in this church, having this type of an understanding, and the society around, I mean the congregation that sees all of this marriage take place, they are expecting that you're going to abide by the rules. See the point? And those rules may be far more extensive than the state of California or the state of New York would require. You see, maybe far more, because they could involve all types of religious duties that you are expected to do, and you both agree to them, you see. And when the marriage ceremony is being given, the preacher may often ask, what about this? Will you do this? Will you do this? Will you do this? Will you do this? And the woman says, yes, I do. And will you do this? Do this? Do this? And the man says, I do, or whatever. All right, that is an agreement being made in the presence of that religious community. And if you want to live in that community, you are expected to abide by it. And you know, I want to tell you what I would say, state most dogmatically in this case, though I guess I should put it as a suggestion, but I think this is biblical. I would say if two people want to have a contract of marriage within the religious persuasion of a particular group, and you want to stay in that group, whatever you do, don't be a hypocrite. Abide by the principles of that group. Because when you got up there to be married, and they expect certain moral and social and ethical things to be performed by both of you, so that you, as man and wife, will live within their society, then you should abide by it. Now, if you don't want to abide by that, then get out. Get out into the society which will accept, you know, the way that you look at things. Now, that's just the way it is. Now, the Apostle Paul said that we ought to abide by the laws of the state, Romans chapter 13, verses 1 through 8. And if we're going to be in, let's say, citizens of the state of California or wherever, well then, for the basic requirements of marriage, we should abide by them if we're going to be in that state. Now, that is what the Apostle Paul says. If you want to be a part of the Christian church, though, and of a Christian community, and there are all different types of them, and some are very strict, and some are not too strict, whatever you wish to affiliate yourself with or to be a part of, and you want to be married in and you want to stay in, you should, from the biblical principle, stay within the confines of that contract. Because by being married in that church or within that denomination, you are not only tacitly but overtly saying to everybody, I want to be a part of this society, this church society in which I am, and I want to be a married, contracted person, two persons, in it. And so stay by the principles. Now I will say this, in Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4, the Apostle Paul, and I think he was the one who wrote Hebrews, said, marriage is honorable in all, he means in all things, and the bed undefiled, but whoremongers and adulterers God will judge. All right. He says marriage is honorable in all things. I take that to mean all things. You can interpret it for what you please. It says the bed undefiled. A man and a wife, if they're in the privacy of their home and they're married, the way the Apostle Paul would look at it here, there is no one that could interfere with what they do in privacy. Now, that is what the Apostle Paul is trying to say. But now I want to come back, though, to something. If two people married within a church, a very strict church, and that church utterly demanded certain things, you know, and you're going to be hypocritical, and even though you know the Bible says certain things are all right on a moral or ethical point of view, and it certainly is in most cases, of course, it's for you to determine what is right and what is wrong on these cases. But if you think right and wrong is going to be determined by a church, all right, then abide by the principles of that church if you're going to be in it. This is abiding by a contract. You see the point? That's exactly what it is. Now, adultery, he says, and fornication, I should say adultery and whoremongering, he says God will judge. All right, adultery means, it's a legal term, meaning that you or a person has taken up sexual contact with another when the agreement is that you wouldn't, that you'd stay pure to each other. You see the point? And some, though, might even say shaking another woman's hand could be leading toward adultery. And in some strict denominations, do you know, that would be grounds for divorce, or not divorce necessarily, but for condemnation, because they would consider it as arousing a man or arousing a woman. Believe me, they would consider that as adultery. You have to interpret what adultery is, how far you go, you know, on some of these things in certain societies. I just understood last week that in Saudi Arabia, I beg your pardon, it's in Iran, the Islamic government over there, being very religious, have stated that two people cannot kiss if it has sexual overtones to it. Well, that is most remarkable. That is the law of the land at the present time over there. If you want to be an Islamic person and live in Iran, I guess that's what you're going to have to go by. I don't interpret that as being bad at all, personally. And I don't think the Bible would say that that is it. But if you're going to live in a society, be it religious, be it political, or just whatever, and you want to be a part of that, and you're married within that context, then abide by the principles of it. Because you see, we have secular United States marriage laws, we have religious laws in the United States by religious groups, and there are 666 of them, and then like I say, in Iran or Arabia, well, in Arabia you can have four women at the present time if you're an Islamic person, if you can afford them. You can have five women, however, you're committing adultery. But you're not committing adultery with four, you see. It depends on the society that you're in, and the people making contracts of marriage within the societies are governed by the societies. Now, that is what is important. The key to the whole thing of marriage in our modern society, or throughout all time, is the contract. The contract, and what is understood to be the contract. On sexual matters, on matters of estate, that is inheritance, on matters of whatever. Whatever it is, the contract is made within the environment, within the society, and you're expected to keep that if you want to be in that society. Now, what I want, as Ernest Martin, is to have God's general way, a precise or beautiful way of looking at things, and not to have any church, not to have any secular organization try to tell me what is right or wrong on some of these things. I want to adopt the principles of God's Holy Spirit, and especially within the environment of honesty, with fairness, of goodness, of consideration to other people, and not taking anything off of any other people too, you know, where they want to force something on me. But the point is, if I wish to live in the society of California where I am, and I think I'm a nice guy and a pretty decent guy, I want to live here so that my neighbors are not upset with me and I'm not upset with them. And I want to abide by the laws as best as possible, as Paul said to do in Romans chapter 13. Now, in the time of the New Testament, it was perfectly proper, though marriage was for life. Normally, that's what Christ said. If the contract was not obeyed by one party, or if both of them agreed to disband the contract, then they could petition God for the whole matter, and it was possible to be divorced, to be loosed. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul is talking about unmarried people there. He says there are virgins who have never been married, there are people who are widows or widowers, and they are those who are loosed. To loose, the word is very strong. It means like tied together, like shoestring, and then you're unloosed. It's all right to get divorced if the society allows the divorce. It's bad, of course, but you see, when you get married, if two people know that divorce is a possibility, well, then it's not just against absolutely everything or society if, for some reason or other, in the future, something happens where they get divorced. It's all a matter of a legal agreement, you see, and the understanding that people have about these matters. And I say this as a suggestion. If you belong to a society, a church, that has strict rules, and you married within that, and you're staying within it, keep them. Don't be a hypocrite. If you don't belong to a church, you can set any contractual agreements between yourselves you want to, you and the wife or the husband you want to marry. But obey the state laws. That is, obey the laws of the land. Obey common sense and be fair and be considerate. The key is love, really. Practice the principles of loving people. Be kind, considerate, fair, honest in all of the contracts you make, and especially with one who you want to be a wife or to be a husband. Divorce is okay. It's a sad thing, but still it's okay if one or the other disagree or agree to part. God divorced ancient Israel when they disobeyed the contract. You see, it's clearly in the third chapter of the book of Jeremiah. These things are possible. Now, adultery is something, is when a contract is made between two people to be sexually pure to each other. If that is violated with somebody of the opposite sex, well, then that is adultery. Now, porneia, or fornication, as it says, that we should avoid, it comes from the Greek word porneia, which means being lewd, being promiscuous. And the thing is, that should be avoided. But what is promiscuous to one person may not be to another, you see. Holding hands is promiscuous to some people. And how I well remember my dear mother, I love her to bits. In the old days, she's 89 right now, she would not wear a dress unless it covered her arms, the upper part of her arms. She felt that was promiscuous. Well, most of us don't feel that way today. It depends on circumstances. But anything which is porneia, or the fornication, it doesn't mean sex before marriage in the Bible. It means promiscuity. It means something that is against what society allows, you know, around you. If you're in a church society, it may be very strict. If you're in a secular society, it may not be as strict. But it means avoid that too. It all comes down to being kind and considerate and all of that. Porneia, that is being promiscuous in public, is something the public disapproves of, and you should not do it in public. Some of the things you might do in the privacy of your home as man and wife, though, is entirely different, and that's up to you. The marriage bed is undefiled. Marriage in the Bible, then, is only between a man and a woman. I must say that. It's not between a man and man, and homosexuality is not approved in the Scripture. That is quite true. And contracts made there would not be within conformity to the Holy Scripture. That is quite true. Now, we at FBR are not judges of anyone in these matters. We don't want to do that. All we want to do is to advocate fairness, kindness, honesty, and abiding by the contracts. We also advocate obedience to the law that you live under, the state, or the church, or the society that you live in. Don't be hypocritical about matters. Make the contracts, live within the contracts. If you have to disallow the contracts, do it amicably. God allows that. He did it with Israel. But the thing is, the marriage should last until the lifetime of all. For the children's sake, for your sake, this is the best. But remember, marriage is a contract. It's not a vow. Stay with the contract, and God will be pleased.